Session number 26579.
Mr. Clark, Reel 10. Now, what were you actually doing with this other company on detachment at Sacred Hill Camp?
Right. It was mainly patrols, once again, on the frontier, but pretty well back from the frontier. It was mainly just to check the roads, have little observation posts up in the hillsides, with one main observation post on one of the highest peaks. Now, you went up there for a month. And I, there was myself...
You mean at Sacred Hill for a month, or at least?
Sacred Hill, yeah. Bearing in mind that we were almost on the Chinese frontier. Now, there was one main post that we had to be manned for about a month at a time. It was when I went up there as a sergeant in command. Now, by this time, I'd got my stripes back. I was a full corporal by this time. And myself, a sergeant myself, and eight men. And we were living in little pump tents on the reverse slope, so the Chinese couldn't see us. On the summit of the hill, we were dug in trenches. And it was very, very, very... We had to be very, very careful here. We had to take notes, because just over the frontier, there was a Chinese garrison, military garrison. And we had to watch every day and make notes as to what they were up to, various things that they would be doing, changing guards, drilling. When they were drilling, we had to note the standard of the drilling. And every move that they made, we had to record. And every day, a runner would come up, a motorcyclist would come up to the bottom of the hill and come up. They collect the sergeant's report, take it back to BHQ. Now, we were also continually in radio contact with battalion headquarters, so in the event of anything happening. But the funny thing was, what we couldn't understand was, we took all our weapons up with us, this party, but we weren't allowed to take a round of ammunition. So in effect, what happened was that we were up on this post, in actual fact, forward frontline troops with our weapons, but no ammunition. Ammunition was back in the company about 3 miles back. So it was quite a scary thing, really. When we asked why this was, they were told, oh, we can't upset the Chinese. We're not allowed to have armed soldiers up here like them. So they said in the event of any of us firing a weapon, it could cause trouble. And we tried to point out to them that if they fired weapons, it would cause us bigger trouble. But nobody would listen to us. So that was the thing, and it was terrific. There was an old Chinese guy used to come up every day with a massive load on his back. It was all goodies, Mars bars, Coca-Colas, crisps and all sorts that he would sell us, like, no? So it was, and we were lucky, the weather at that stage was pretty good. We didn't have any bother with cold or rain. It was quite warm by the time our turn came about. Then at the end of the month, the motorcyclist would bring up any mail for us from the company. You'd get the mail and bring it up to us every day. So in that respect, it was pretty, a change from battalion life.
And what about the actual patrols? Do you remember anything about them? I mean, you know.
They were very brief, actually. They were just foot patrols. We would do maybe a section under command of a corporal. We would patrol parallel to the border, but not on the border, maybe about a mile or so away from the border, just to make sure that nothing got through. And there was one little village there, Sheng Shui, right on the border, which was strictly out of bounds to us. But on a couple of nights, I've known one or two of us to slip in there, have a few beers. I think it was just the spirit of bravado.
Did you do it?
I did, yeah, a couple of times. And the thing in there, the police in this little village, Sheng Shui, they were in civvies, the police, but they walked about with rifles. And They were dead chuffed to get us in. We'd take them into a bar and buy them a few beers because they were literally poverty stricken. And they were quite happy to see us coming in, and they'd come in and put their rifle over behind the bar and have a drink with us, like, you know. And they would slip back. So that was life up there. Now, the social life was pretty non-existent, really. We'd it's canteen where we could get in there at nights and sit and have a few beers. Or sometimes the sergeant or the colour sergeant would organise tombola on a pay night. We were not allowed down into Hong Kong or we were not allowed down to Hong Kong Monday to Friday. We were only allowed to go there Saturday and Sunday. So we get allowed out on this. On a Saturday morning, we used to have RSM's parade, drill parade, which was held at Fanling, at battalion headquarters. And by this time, we had a new RSM. RSM Bowman.
Bowman, now how do you spell that?
B-O-W-M-A-N. RSM Bowman took over just before we left Trieste. And he was the opposite of his predecessor, Elwood. Bowman was a beast. But, having said that, he was a very fair man. He was of the old school. And he used to go through life growling at everybody. But by the same token, he was still respected. So what would happen on a Saturday morning, we would get into trucks and drive down to Battalion HQ, go into Three Tunners and get off there, and then we'd be inspected. A company at a time would be inspected. You wouldn't know which company was going to be inspected. He would just suddenly say, right, C company this morning. And then maybe again the following week you'd inspect C company as well, just so that we wouldn't get cushy. Then when the RSM's parade was finished, which was usually about 10, half 10, go back to the company, and then that was us finished for the rest of the day. And we're allowed to go down into Kowloon or Hong Kong. We'd get the train down, and that was quite an ordeal, because there was no special military transport. The trains would be packed with Chinese, and they're all the Chinese coolie types, workers in the field, like, you know. So the trains would be packed and be hanging on, just like as you see in India, hanging on the outside and on the roofs and everything, like, you know. The only time you saw Cameroonians acting like that was on the way back when they were drunk. But still, once again, it was an experience.
And what would you do when you got to Kowloon or Hong Kong?
Kowloon, the main thing was we'd go to the nappy club there, the big nappy club there, and get a meal. There was nothing exotic about the nappy club. It was just a restaurant and then a bar. And there's nothing, as I say, there's nothing really exotic about it. It was just pretty mundane. Hong Kong, slightly a wee bit more upmarket. We had to go across in a ferry and go along across there. And it wasn't on a par with Trieste, put it that way, socially. It wasn't on a par at all. But it was sufficient for us. After all, we were 5 days up in the hills, and then a night weekend down there, being able to get dressed up in your best battle dress or best jungle greens, and go down there Saturday and Sunday. We had to be back again on a Saturday night, back for midnight. And as long as we got off the midnight train, the military police, the regimental police were there checking us off. And as long as you were back at Fanling by midnight, they would phone through to the company, the people who had arrived on the train, and you had about 15 minutes to get yourself back to the company. There was only a tragic accident happened there. I'll never forget. He's a bloke called Corporal Wilkie. Corporal Wilkie, W-I-L-K-I-E. He was the ration store corporal. And there's no platforms on the station. You just step straight off the ground onto the steps. And poor old Wilkie this night, coming back from Hong Kong, wasn't drunk. He was a guy that didn't drink a lot. He fell under the train, accidentally fell under the train and was killed. And That puts a bit of a dampener on it for that weekend, like, no. And then so many of us were detailed to attend his funeral that we had a burial party, and I was, which included me, and we were down at the cemetery, was called the Happy Valley Cemetery, and we were a very impressive ceremony down there. And as far as I can remember, that was the only death we had in Hong Kong. Life was quite mundane there. There wasn't a lot to do. Once again, we were restricted by lack of space.
Now, what about, how long were you at Sacred Heart then?
Sacred Hill.
Sacred Hill, sorry.
Yeah. We were there right till we left.
So you were stayed there throughout?
That's right, yeah. Now then, as I say, life was, there wasn't all much doing there. We didn't have much of a social life, but we did quite a lot. The only thing was we did march up and down the hills on various occasions with a platoon march up the hill to a grid reference and then back to another grid reference. Now, the object, by the way, of, we had a lot of PE in Sacred Hill. The object of the exercise was, we didn't know it then, but the powers that be knew it, that we would be moving to Malaya. And we were extremely fit by the time we left Hong Kong. We had PE every day. And these hill marches were pretty exhausting. And there was literally no sport. There was no sport there. There was no facilities, in actual fact. So by the time our tour of duty in Hong Kong came to an end, we were pretty fit. Now, our tour there only extended 6 months.
So that would be from December to?
To about June. And then we were ready to pack up for Malaya.
And how did you feel about the prospect of a post into Malaya? When did you find out? When did you feel?
We discovered we were going to Malaya about 6 weeks before we embarked.
How did you feel about that?
Well, it was just another adventure for us. However, it was a bit, our briefing for this one was a bit more somber than before. We were warned that this was us going into active service, which none of us had, or very little of us had seen. And we were told, like, you know, that the situation in Malaya was pretty fraught, that the terrorists were killing a hell of a lot of people and killing a lot of soldiers as well. So they said, like, that it wouldn't be a cakewalk. Anyway, we arrived in Malaya and disembarked, and immediately went into...
Which port? Where did you land?
When?
Where?
Where? Oh, Singapore Island, that's the fact. I already said Singapore, didn't I?
You went... No.
All right, anyway.
You said you'd been to Singapore before, yeah.
That's right, yeah.
But that was on the way out to Hong Kong.
Well, my geography let me down there. Don't worry, sorry.
It's all right, don't worry.
Anyway, we arrived in Singapore, and we were then driven up to a transit camp there, which was very, very, very sparse, all under canvas. And we were then briefed by the brigadier of the 26th Gurkha Brigade to the fact that this was going to be no holiday camp. Our tour of duty in Malaya was going to be very, very... it was going to be very, very rough. We're going to spend a lot of time in the jungle and be prepared to be killed or badly wounded. He was very forthright, the brigadier. A guy called Pugh, Brigadier Pugh, P-E-W. I believe he's one of the biggest, youngest brigadiers ever to serve in the British Army. And then what happened then was the camp we were in, in actual fact, was called Nee Soon Camp, two letters, N-E-E, Soon, S-O-O-N, Nee Soon Camp. And then, after about 2 weeks there, the colonel got us together. By this time, the colonel had changed now. We now had Colonel Bill Henning, Colonel Henning.
Henning,
H-E-N-N-I-N-G.
What was he like?
Affectionately known as Wild Bill Henning. Bill was a veteran of Burma. He'd served as a young subaltern in Burma. Very good man. We didn't see much of him, really. But what the short meeting I did have with him, or the short briefings we had with him, he sounded very genuine. We were then... All the junior NCOs were given a briefing by the company commander to the effect that this campaign was going to be virtually a corporal's war, a section commander's war, and that most of us would be going up country to the Far Elf Training Centre, a place called Tampoi, T-A-M-P-O-I, Tampoi, where it was just over the border in Johor Bahru, southern Johor. Now this was a massive big, had been pre-war, had been a massive mental asylum. Brick built buildings, and the rooms were very comfortable, big comfortable room, with the fans in the roof, which kept the temperature cool. We then started training under special staff, permanent staff.
Hang on, now, was this at Nee Soon or at Tampoi?
Tampoi.
You moved up there. What was the journey like up there?
Oh, it was very, very quick. It wasn't all that far. We got up to Johor Bahru and we crossed over off the island. There's a bridge there and we drove into southern Johor. The state of Johor, which was the southernmost state of Malaya. And then just about 10 miles, 12 miles up the road was this a Far Elf Training Centre, Tampoi. Now, we were then under the care of a permanent staff there, and they taught us the art of jungle warfare, how to lead in the jungle, and how to react in the event of ambushes, how to react and eventually suddenly hitting the enemy.
Now, how were you? Can you tell us a bit more about it? In other words, what were you meant to do?
We attended lectures, and then from lectures, we watched demonstrations, Gurkha demonstration squads doing the various manoeuvres and carrying out the various drills that had to be carried out. And then we would carry them out.
What I mean is, what were the drills? You remember them now. What was the principles they were trying to get? Not perhaps, you might not remember the details, but was the idea?
One of the drills was how to lay an ambush.
How would you lay an ambush?
You laid an ambush on one side of a road, and you would lay an ambush on one side of the road, and you'd have a guy out on either side. And you weren't allowed to speak in the jungle. Everything was given by signals. So these two guys at either end of this ambush set up would look out on the flanks. And if they saw anything, we'd watch these guys as well. And they'd give a signal. And the signal was a thumbs down if we spotted the enemy. So that was that. You also had another ambush situation where you would ambush a track with grenades, 36 grenades, with a little box at the end, electrical system, with one wire in, and you put the other wire in, and this would explode the grenades, that kind of thing. We were then taught that...
Now, what were you meant to do if you were ambushed? That's another thing you mentioned, but, I mean, you know, when the boot was on the other foot.
As it was such close quarter combat, there wasn't a really great drill that was to be carried out. We were taught just to fight back as quickly and gain the initiative as quickly as possible, or get the hell out of it, you know. But it, as I say, it was a totally different kind of warfare. It wasn't open warfare. If you were suddenly ambushed, which my section was later on, which I'll tell you about later on, it was just a question of kill as many of the enemy as quickly as possible, if you could manage that. But as I say, there's so many obstructions in your way, like the trees, for example, and plus the fact the terrain was dreadful. So if you get caught in a swamp, you could be in big trouble. But it was just the whole essence of the training was virtually common sense and how to react to an enemy. It was as simple as that, like, you know. And we did a month there. And this school was commanded by a Cameroonian called the Lieutenant Colonel Jock Law. And he's an excellent chap. And there was another major there called Major T, a Gurkha officer, T-E-E. And also a very, very famous British soldier, Mad Mike Calvert, Major Calvert, who was a legend in the Burma campaign. He was a brigadier during the war, commanded the columns under the Chindit columns. He then was by this time being brought down to major, and he was one of the instructors at this school. Fantastic bloke, and everybody thought the world of him. Then, when the month's training was finished, by this time our battalion had moved up country, and I and another couple of C Company NCOs, junior NCOs, we rejoined the battalion further up country, about 120 miles up country, in a place called Muar, M-U-A-R.
M-U-A-R.
Where battalion headquarters was stationed. The battalion once again split all over the place. Now, I believe, if my memory serves me correctly, the battalion was split over an area of 300 miles. All companies all over the place. Wherever they tried to get the companies near where they would thought they'd be they'd be operational, where the terrorists would be operational. We were sent up to the Lop Rubber Estate, about 10 miles outside of the Moor, and we were under canvas up here. The company set up was at the company commander's office and administration offices were wooden. They were in actual fact wooden structures. The remainder, we were in the squad, what they called squad tents.
And what were they like? Can you?
Very, very comfortable, in actual fact.
Can you describe one? Because they sound mean.
Just a big squad tent. It was a big, I can't describe it hardly now, but massive big tent. And it would hold about an NCO and 10 men. And they were quite comfortable. We had our ordinary beds, mattresses, and blankets, as per normal, like, you know. Now, this camp was virtually a fortress.
Did it have a name?
No, it didn't have a name, no. It was just C Company, Dunlop, Rubber Estate.
Dunlop.
Rubber Estate, yeah. Now, needless to say that we were right in the middle of a rubber estate. We could look out at our tents in the camp every day, and see the rubber tappers tapping the trees and watching all the rubber flow into little cups on the trees and whatever. Quite interesting. Another learning thing in our lives. The company was a virtual fortress. We were actually barbed wire all round. We were absolutely enclosed by barbed wire. And 24 hours a day, there was four-man patrol. One going one round one way, and one going round the other way. Fully armed. One up the spout, all sorts of grenades, and their pouches and what have you, because it had been known for army camps to be attacked. So the state of the of alertness was quite high, with especially our company, with this company commander. Our company commander was very, very security conscious. Now, what would then happen is, now, by this time, the platoons weren't all that big now, because if we were suffering from a manpower shortage in the regiment at that
time.
Now,
why was that?
Well, we don't know. We believe it was to do with recruitment, lack of recruitment back home at this particular time. It was put down to that. However, we didn't have a platoon commander as such, an officer. We had a sergeant called Sergeant Brown, who commanded us. Danny, I believe Danny was an ex-Burma chap as well. He was an ex-Burma campaign man, and excellent. So what would happen is that the company commander, initially, used to take the patrols out himself, initially. And it started off by doing three-day patrols. We would pile into the trucks and we'd go to a certain spot, a certain grid reference in the road. Now, the thing was that these roads were virtually empty. They were lovely concrete roads, but similar to American setup. Big, long roads, but they're practically empty. So we would be dropped up, we would be dropped off at a certain grid reference.
Now, how many of you?
They'd say approximately the company commander, his batman, Sergeant Brown, myself, a lance corporal, and about 10 men, approximately.
Now, what would you be carrying with you?
We were all dressed in jungle green, with a little floppy jungle green hats. We had a massive big jungle green rucksacks, pouches. The whole equipment was totally different from what we've been used to. And we wore also canvas boots, long canvas, calf length boots made of canvas and laced right up.
Now, what, as you mentioned, what was this jungle green kit like, the jungle equipment like, in comparison?
The whole secret of equipment is by making sure your belt was nice. That was the basis of your equipment. If you got your belt tightened properly, the rest of the equipment would fit on very well, like, you know. And the huge big rucksack with pockets on either side, so you could get quite a lot of food in there. And your pouches were quite big. You could get quite a lot of ammunition in there.
Was the jungle green a good camouflage? I mean, did it work?
Oh yeah, it was pretty, it blended in very well with the jungle. Plus the fact we used to darken our faces as well. Blacken our faces.
Was it too hot?
No, it was humid. It was very, very humid and damp.
No, what I mean is, was the uniform too?
No.
It was lightweight.
Light.
Hard wearing, though?
It was hard wearing, but very light. It was just like the khaki drill, only green. Simple as that, with pockets in the shirts.